Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or on demand, we'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program, investor Romeo Kamalo says the Optasia listing is a turning point for fintech and African capital flow. A new report warns of deep-rooted violence against children and calls for urgent reform. Hopes rise for a malaria-free future as new vaccines start to roll out, and South African firms are boosting digital defenses amid escalating global cyber threats. It's Thursday, the 6th of November. Now, you'll know that one of South Africa's biggest fintech stories of the year, Optasia's blockbuster debut on the JSE, raising something in the region of 6.5 billion rand, but also sending a strong signal that local capital markets still have global pulling power. Among the early backers cashing in is LLH Capital, co-founded by broadcaster-turned-investor Romeo Kamalo. Now, the listing marks the largest fintech IPO in years and has revived confidence, I think, in the JSE's ability to attract high-growth tech players. So what does this deal then tell us about South Africa's investment climate? And I wonder what Romeo Kamalo's next bet is. Well, Romeo, a very warm welcome to you. First of all, let's just talk about the success of the listing. What does it tell us, in your opinion, about the state and maybe even the future of South Africa's capital markets?
Well, I think there's confidence in South Africa's capital markets. Optasia was oversubscribed, and also just about South Africa's fintech market, and also the confidence that investors have on the fintech industry in South Africa and across the African continent.
Why do you think that confidence prevails right now? And there is concern that maybe that bubble is about to burst. Where's your head in that space?
Well, we don't think so, Jeremy. If you look at the African continent and if you look at the increase in smartphone penetration, if you look at what's happening with digitization and internet connectivity, we think there's huge opportunity for growth on the African continent. If you look at what AI, the opportunity that AI presents in terms of the different industries and services, we think that it's going to help many of the founder-led innovative businesses to leapfrog in many services. So we see that if you look at our model around the convergence of telecommunications and financial services, we think there's a lot of opportunities for growth. And that's why investors have just gone confidently into stocks like Optasia.
So how does the continent then capitalize on the appetite and the potential that you are outlining to me?
Well, you know, we are raising this big fund to back founder-led businesses. And we think that there are a lot of Optasias that are waiting to be discovered and scaled. Our model is to find AI digital-led businesses that are innovating. And there are a lot of young, not even young, there are a lot of businesses out there that need capital, that need operational expertise, that need strategic leadership, access to networks, access to capital. And we are there to find those businesses and help them to scale.
So what kind of criteria would you then apply to your model going forward, given that it is risky and there is also, a lot of chaff in amongst the wheat?
Well, we generally look for businesses that are solving real problems. You know, many of these businesses, founder-led businesses, have got founders that are solving real problems, tech that is solving real problems in the market. And so there's many businesses that we've invested in, businesses like Ozo, businesses like Sandmark, Flow Living, and Bottles. And we've seen the model that's worked in Optasia. And so those are the kind of business that we are looking for.
How do you assess risk, though, when investing in founder-led businesses such as the ones that you're chasing versus those maybe with a little bit more weight with institutional governance structures?
Look, it takes a long time to invest, and we have a risk model that we use to ensure that these businesses can sustain funding and make sure that we can get the kind of risk adjustment return on investment on our capital. So there's a long way to ensure that we can work with these founder-led businesses. And it takes a while. You need to make sure that you're working with businesses that have tech that is investable and people have done it before. So yeah, it's not easy. We've done it before, and we need to make sure that these businesses can sustain, that tech is sustainable.
As far as Optasia is concerned, why was now the right moment for LLH to realize part of its stake? Was it about timing, market conditions, or is it simply a strategic rotation play?
Very strategic for us. We had been with Optasia for almost 10 years now. We've sold down a significant portion of our investment. We've kept a bit of equity, but we think there's other opportunities in the market to look at. And so it was a strategic alignment for our portfolio, and we think there's other AI-driven ventures that we can look at this point in time.
Take me back to the beginning, Romeo. What was the original investment thesis behind backing Optasia?
You know, we met the founder and close to about 2016. I remember 16th of August, 2016. At the time, I mean, I was looking now, Jeremy, at the investment thesis that we had at the time of the convergence of telecoms and financial services. And I remember chatting to Basim, the founder, around his tech of solving real problems and around financial inclusivity. And we flew to London and flew to Athens, met the team, looked at the tech, and we thought there's something here special around making sure that we can include a lot of Africans around financial services and inclusivity. And the tech was robust, and we thought there was something really special around here in terms of introducing this amazing tech to the likes of Vodacom and others, but also just amazingly, the way he had assembled an amazing team around him.
Are there key lessons from the Optasia journey then, Romeo, whether it be in growth, whether it be in governance or timing even, that's going to inform your next deal then?
Oh, yes. If you look at the journey around operational expertise, if you look at the journey around the tech, if you look at the journey around governance, if you look at the journey around the collaborative investors that we brought on board, there are many, many lessons that that we can take from this amazing investment on Optasia to take on to the rest of the other ventures that we're looking at. It's been an amazing journey with this team, and we will continue to work with the Optasia team as well to take some of the insights and the learnings to the next ones.
Other ventures that you're looking at. So where do you see the next strategic opening for African capital in the next cycle?
Many others in the in financial services and telecoms, we really think that this space of growth around African digitization, and we think that the increase in smartphone penetration and AI is what's going to drive growth in Africa. And so a lot of the ventures that we're looking to back are businesses that are changing people's lives, but they are also innovating around digitization and around financial inclusivity.
How do you tell African naysayers, though, that there is opportunity on the continent? Is that a difficult discussion to have?
You know, we engage with investors in the U.S. and in recent times I was in Silicon Valley talking to investors around AI. I spent a week there meeting different entrepreneurs and investors. And of course, they have a different view around the continent. In fact, they know nothing about what's happening on the African continent. And so when you start talking to them about the digital dividend and the opportunities that Africa presents, you know, they start looking at it, you know, from a different perspective. So, yeah, it is very, very hard, particularly when you talk about risk on the African continent. What they see and what they read about Africa is just risk and wars. And so it is hard when you start talking to investors about the opportunities in Africa. But we believe on the continent, and we believe that this continent has many, many opportunities, particularly around financial services and telecoms. And what AI presents now is an opportunity to leapfrog in many of these sectors.
Romeo Kamalo, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
This week, the South African Child Gauge 2025 has revealed a stark warning that violence against children remains one of the country's deepest and most persistent crises. From homes to schools and communities, children continue to face physical, emotional and structural harm, and that threatens their futures. Well, joining me now is Professor Shanaz Matthews, Director of the Children's Institute at the University of Cape Town, lead researcher on the report. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. And the report, while making for very disturbing reading, calls for an integrated response to violence against women and children. What does that mean, and what's actually stopping that from happening across departments right now?
I think critically, you know, we've been working in silos for decades. We've addressed violence against women, we've addressed violence against children in our policies and in our programs and departments. We've got a Department of Women, and children are located in the Department of Social Services, which means our responses are not integrated at all. It's very siloed. What this means is that all our responses think about either the child that they see in front of them or the woman that they see in front of them without thinking of the implications one has on the other. And it means that we don't have a joined up response. And there is the possibility of, you know, what we are doing also is that we're not maximizing our resources then in terms of how we're reaching women and children and reducing the plight that they're enduring.
Do you think there's any appetite at this point for the kind of coordination that you're referring to?
Well, we had the minister at our launch and she listened and said that it does make sense for children to be within the Department of Women and People with Disabilities. The challenge is that our policies are quite siloed and we've got to have policies speak to each other. I've worked in the sector for more than 30 years. I've worked with women and I've worked with children. But you see in front of you, when you see either women or children, so when a child comes into a service, they need a family that's able to support them. But trauma often runs very deep and it's intergenerational. So a mother that comes into a service with a child that's been sexually abused, often for the first time talk about her own abuse, whether it is intimate partner violence or her own experience of being sexually abused. And that in itself means that services need to be joined up. She requires to deal with her own trauma before she's able to deal with the trauma the child has experienced. And therein lies our problem. If we only start thinking about the person we see in front of us, we're not going to break this intergenerational cycle of violence that drives our problem in South Africa.
Professor, the report also quantifies the human and economic cost of violence. But if Treasury is cutting budgets, is it difficult to make a single compelling argument which would make prevention of this problem a fiscal priority? I sense that it's a difficult one to get across the line.
It's incredibly difficult when there's cutbacks across departments. We know research conducted in South Africa looking at the cost of violence against children shows us that in 2015, it cost about 5% of the GDP. And that's huge. And that doesn't even account for all the long-term impacts of violence. We also know that the outcomes for young children that have experienced or been exposed to violence means that it impacts on the educational outcomes as well as long-term health and well-being. So if you don't invest in a child early to ensure that they're safe, it's cost to South African society at every turn. It means children drop out from school, they don't reach their full potential. It also means that you actually going to burden the economy with an unproductive adult. And therefore, it's really critical that we start shifting our mindset and our argument with, and we have to make an investment case to Treasury that it is critical to be investing. The minister said on Tuesday that the UK government's going to be supporting South Africa with an additional grant for violence, and particularly around prevention of violence against boys. And I think that's important because bringing thinking about how to shift violence means we've also got to be thinking about how we shift social norms that perpetuates violence against women and children. And therein lies some of our problems, because it's not just about response, and having response systems in place to break the cycle means we've also got to be having interventions within communities that can break the cycle, that can shift the norms that perpetuates these forms of violence.
And additionally, Professor, you can't manage the problem unless you can measure it. And your report calls for, and I quote, multi-sectoral data systems to track violence. But I guess the question is, how close are we to having real-time integrated data? I suspect probably not as far as we should be. And where then is the weakest link?
Well, the weakest link is that our data systems don't speak to each other. So education has a system, health has a system, social development has a system, and none of these systems speak to each other. In order for us to measure outcomes for children, all our systems should be able to speaking to each other. We have an ID number that one can use simple to link data sources. And this is so critical to be able to see outcomes. You've got to be able to track these data systems. The problem is that it's so costly to be implementing surveys year on year with no money. It means we just don't have the money to do that. But it's really critical, because if we want to see progress as a nation, we should be able to show what, you know, from our data that's real time.
Well, the report does make for some very stark reading. Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Professor Shanaz Matthews, Director of the Children's Institute at the University of Cape Town.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it seems there is rising optimism in Africa's ongoing fight against malaria. New vaccine rollouts, improved prevention tools, and growing political commitment are driving hopes that the continent could finally turn the tide on a disease that still claims hundreds of thousands of lives a year, mostly children. But despite promising vaccine results in pilot countries, Africa still carries 95% of the global malaria burden, and weak health systems threaten to slow the rollout. Well, let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Dr. Chris von Straten from International SOS. He is Global Health Advisor, Clinical Governance. Chris, it's always good to talk to you, and thank you indeed. What measurable impact then have these malaria vaccines shown in African pilot countries so far? Is there any optimism to report here?
So first off, the RTS and R21 vaccines that have now been RTS on the market since about 2019. And when I say on market, actually more in studies in these different countries. And it is encouraging. I think something that a lot of people don't necessarily know is that most of malaria deaths, three quarters of deaths, are in kids under the age of five. These vaccines were built specifically for that population. And in some of the studies, we're seeing some fantastic reductions in A, people getting sick from malaria, and B, dying. So there is, of course, to be optimistic. There are some fantastic results, but the malaria in parts of Africa is still rife. The capacity of the organisms to evolve and adapt is very real. And then also the logistics of rolling out complicated vaccines is not easy. And we still encounter, unfortunately, a lot of stigma around vaccination in many parts of the world. So our work is not far from being done yet.
Let's talk about overcoming the stigma in just a moment. But against that backdrop then, Chris, how soon can we realistically expect a widespread rollout across SADC countries? Are we fairly close to that point?
No, not yet. So first off, all the vaccines are still in study phases to make sure that they're safe, to make sure that we understand the what kind of dosing and schedules still need to be administered. So far, it's looking very encouraging. So that's the first part. The second part is getting people to adopt and to take up. So that is ongoing. And even once that is done, it's still a massive project to make sure that then there's the funding to may take it from a big study into ongoing government policy, government procedure. And I think the other important thing too, and a lot of academics and smarter people than I are emphasizing this, the vaccines on their own are not going to end malaria globally or in Africa. We really have to look at all the tools that we have, and that includes things like prophylaxis medications, that includes vector control, killing the mosquitoes where they breed, it is the mosquito nets, etc., that will make the big impact in the long term.
But key to success, as you say, is adopting the process, and part of that is overcoming this stigma, which is easier said than done. Is there a solution? Is there a starting point here? Or is that going to be the biggest stone you have to push uphill?
My gut, and this is just me, as an individual who's been in the malaria space for over 10 years and also working in corporate medicine for over a decade, Jeremy, it still astounds me that I've given malaria talks for over 10 years, and I've given it to some of the brightest businessmen on the planet. And it still astounds me. I can meet a room of 100 smart people, including CEOs, and I can ask them, how many of you wear a seatbelt? And 100% will put their hand up. And they look at me like, well, of course, that's just smart. And then I ask the exact same audience, I say, how many of you take your malaria prophylaxis daily and as prescribed when traveling in malaria-endemic countries? And two-thirds of the audience will look at their cell phone, they'll look away, and a very small number look me in the eye and go, yeah, of course, because that's just the right thing to do. In fact, it was so severe that the UK government NHS had a study in 2016 commissioned, and it showed that two-thirds of expats in traveling in endemic countries are non-compliant by month three, and the costs and implications can be dire. Anything from, hey, I've got malaria, which can be treated early, to, hey, I've got cerebral malaria, I'm brain damaged, having strokes, and or now end organ failure and death. So the human part of it is, I don't have the answer yet.
Do you think it's ignorance or fear that drives that mindset?
So in many of the audiences I've engaged, it cannot be ignorance, because these are individuals with tertiary education and running multi-million dollar companies. I think a lot of it has to do with fear and perception. And it's fascinating. Think back to when I was a kid. Seatbelts were a thing, but it was still gaining momentum. Now I think people will frown at you. My family and friends certainly would if I didn't wear a seatbelt. And the same with smoking. Mm. Now, I think malaria still needs to get to a point where it becomes like, oh, hang on, this is a real thing, and it's completely preventable and completely treatable.
I mentioned at the start of our conversation that there is a degree of growing political commitment, and that's a good thing, but I would imagine that's not necessarily translating into actual budget allocation just yet.
Yeah, good point and a good question. And yes, exactly that. Prior to 2020, malaria funding, but also the impact, we could see from the numbers that malaria incidents and deaths were on the back foot, they were declining. Then 2020 pitches up, and it's really the perfect storm. You have the COVID-19 pandemic, resources, energy, political focus has shifted. And then we're also seeing these climate change patterns. We're seeing high rainfall and warm areas, especially in North and South Africa, and seeing malaria year-round, where only we used to see it in the warm summer months and never saw it in the cold, dry winter months. And as we know, there's been political shift in certain countries where massive funding cuts have happened in parts of Africa for many concerns like malaria. So I want to try and give a balanced picture on this. I'm still optimistic. And I think for countries like South Africa, where we only really have malaria transmission up on the northern borders, I think our chances are really good if we use all the tools at hand and think really long and hard about the subtle psychology of a lot of what we have to do. And it's going to be more challenging, though, I think, in some of the less well-resourced and more really rural areas where the funding might not get through.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Chris van Straaten from International SOS, Global Health Advisor.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Cybersecurity is sharply in focus this week as new global research shows South African companies stepping up investments to counter fast-evolving digital threats. PwC's latest Digital Trusts Insights survey finds around 63% of South African executives now rank cyber risk investment among their top three strategic priorities, interestingly higher than their global peers. But I want to talk about this in a little more detail. Junaid Amra is with us, PwC's cybersecurity and forensics technology solutions leader. Junaid, a very warm welcome. So why are South African executives ranking cyber risk higher than their global peers?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. It's actually interesting. I think from a South African perspective, what's been interesting is we've had sustained focus in this area. If you're looking at things like our King 3, King 4 reports, etc. So IT has been on the agenda maybe a bit higher, and a lot of focus from a governance and board level came into play through some of the corporate governance sort of frameworks that were adopted through this period. At least in my opinion, that seems to be accounting for the better synergies we're seeing even at an exec level. If you look at your C-suite engagement with the security officers, etc., there seems to be we're outpacing the global averages in that sort of engagement.
It was interesting to read that the survey shows what is termed strong core controls. That's all well and good, but where would the remaining blind spots be then?
Yeah, so, and maybe just to comment on those strong core controls, right? So that's speaking to your base security controls that we've had over the years. And obviously the survey seems to point to very high numbers from a South African perspective. But in practice and experience, I think there may be a level of overconfidence in that space. It could do with some independent assurance and review just to make sure that the perception through the survey is actually matching what's out there on the ground.
I also see that just 6% of your respondents feel confidence about supply chain risk. In other words, threat from beyond the company itself. Why do you think this weakness is so pronounced, and what immediate action needs to be taken in that respect?
Yeah, so supply chain risk has been increasing over the last few years, and what we've been finding is attackers' behavior is changing in this space, right? So there's been a lesser focus from what we've seen in the past in terms of investment into this. There's been a strong investment focus in the last few years on resilience. Supply chain and third-party risks seem to be lagging in the South African context, and that's actually our Achilles heel. If you looked at the survey results, you know, we're coming out stronger on the investment and governance and engagement levels.
So how do you improve the supply chain side of the equation there? What needs to be done?
So what we're starting to see, if you look at the, some of the investment changes, we're finding changes due to the geopolitical risk. And what that's also reshaping is which vendors you're going to be working with, your trade policies, et cetera. And we're starting to see that play into how organizations are starting to deal with these third-party and supply chain type of risks, right? So typically what's happening in those types of attacks, attackers are injecting themselves into your supply chain with modified software, modified hardware that's actually leading to cyber issues, or maybe something that's not at the right level of security that you end up using that results in a breach of sorts. So we can see organizations starting to shift in that direction. That's probably that focus is going to be what drives change in that area.
Junaid, the survey notes better C-suite engagement, which is good, but boards and Exco still surely has misunderstanding around cyber risk, often maybe a little too reactive, investing after incidents instead of ahead of them. What needs to change in that respect? Is it just throwing money at the problem, or more subtle than that?
I think you'll see another area that's increased in focus is risk quantification in terms of cyber risk. So, yes, you know, we get these presentations and discussions at board level of the current threats that are out there, But in terms of quantifying it and contextualizing it for your environment, we're starting to see a major shift in terms of understanding what's your actual exposure. And that's where the risk quantification is coming in. That's also playing into the levels of cyber insurance that organizations are taking out and where do they invest their funds.
And of course, the landscape is changing day by day, isn't it? Given the advent of artificial intelligence, how are companies preparing in that respect? Are they staying ahead of the curve?
So it's hard. It's a maturing technology. Mm. Attackers are obviously starting to leverage AI more and more in various areas. From a defender perspective, you know, it's still taking shape in how we're going to be applying it and how we're going to use it. But we are starting to see investment in that area. South African organizations seem to be in the phase of piloting, running pilots in specific areas of the business. Our global counterparts seem to be already starting enterprise-wide rollouts. I think that's one of the major differences that I've seen in the results. But yes, there is definitely a move into investing into AI-enabled defense.
But therein also lies risk, because that's not going to work unless there's more investment in general talent to manage that process. And we do have a talent shortage in this country, don't we?
No, 100%. And AI is also starting to play a role in that space in terms of areas where we might be lacking capability. South African organizations are investing significantly into looking as to how AI can help plug those skill gaps, right? Mm. So the concepts like agentic AI, where you can mimic the behavior of an individual, et cetera, are starting to be infused into the processes to cover for the skill gaps that we may have.
I'm going to leave it there, and we have been duly warned. Junaid Amra, PwC Cybersecurity and Forensics Technology Solutions Leader, thank you very much indeed. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.